We are speaking with now a professor from the University of Wollongong, actually in Australia. Musicians often sing about environmental problems, but what about the environmental issues tied up with the materials from which their guitars are made? Around 2.6 million guitars are produced annually, but the timberless supply chains on which the guitar industry relies have long been secretive. Many sources of wood are from places with historical legacies of environmental conflict, colonial violence and dispossession, such as rosewoods from Brazil and spruces from the Pacific Northwest. Professor Chris Gibson and his colleague Andrew Warren, both from the University of Wollongong in Australia, spent 6 years tracing guitar making across five continents. I spoke to Professor Chris Gibson earlier and asked how he and his associates started to trace the guitar in this work that they've been doing.
Look, it was a research project that found us by accident, really. We had written a book about surfboard making and the revival in Polynesian board making out of wood. And we were talking to a Hawaiian board maker who was struggling to find trees that were big enough to make surfboards. And we said, oh, do you realise it's the same woods that are made in used to make guitars and ukuleles? And we sort of turned to each other and realised there was it was the next book to be written, really, was just trying to figure out what's happening in the world of guitars in relation to wood. So the first thing that we really did was to hit the road and visit factories to learn how guitars are made and to ask questions about the resource, the wood, and where it comes from. And would it be possible to visit their wood suppliers? And little did we know that the journey would become much longer and more complicated than we first imagined.
Much, much longer, right? Can I just track back a little bit? Is this Tom Pohaku stone that you're talking about that you met in Hawaii?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, who's a fantastic board maker and activist who, is really reviving Hawaiian watercraft practices and ceremonially blesses trees before they're felled. But told us some, very tragic stories, really, about the loss of Hawaiian forests and the trees, including koa, which is an acacia tree that only grows on a very certain band of elevation on Hawaiian volcanoes. So it's a really limited geographical area that it grows in. So he took us on the road to try and find some of those surviving old trees and, it was a real struggle to do so.
How much did that impact both yourself and obviously Andrew Warren, who worked on this piece of research with you? Because that must have been a fascinating thing to be a part of, not having experienced that kind of interaction, that kind of cultural interaction previously.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I played guitar all my life and I didn't really understand or really comprehend that the musical instrument that I love very dearly and, hold in my hands, that the woods in it have come from potentially all over the world and in many cases are hundreds of years old and are sort of bound up in this set of much wider forces that are big forces of world history, really, colonialism and capitalism, the big profound forces that have changed the planet and our landscape, whether it's Hawaiian volcanoes or Brazilian forests and Central European spruce forests, the magnificent conifer forests of the Pacific Northwest and North America. These are where all the, many of the guitar woods come from. And the humble guitar that I just thought I was enjoying playing and playing as loud as I could was actually an object that was caught up in these much bigger histories and these much bigger forces.
And you've said, I think, that this isn't a story necessarily about the guitar. This is about the people behind the guitar, the manufacturers, those who do the felling, and indeed people like Tom who you met. I mean, how much of this was serendipity that you were able to find your way through this over five different continents for so long trying to tell the story?
It was total serendipity. It was, it was really wonderful but bizarre. I mean, the universities these days, they like you to have your research. They almost want you to know what your findings are going to be before you go out and apply for your grants and get your ethics approval. You've almost got to know what you're going to find. This was just the total opposite. Like, we had no real idea where we were going to end up and how far we were going to travel. And coming to face-to-face, really, and confronting some of the kind of difficult truths of the industry was very much a challenge and part of the story.
And as you say, you started in the manufacturers. I'm assuming at the manufacturers in Australia. What were they like when two Aussies, I think you're a guitarist, you said, so you're a shredder and your mate's a surfer, right? So they must have, but you're a professor of geography. And I think Andrew is a professor of economics and geography, I think it is. So what was it like for guitar manufacturers to kind of see these two professors turn up and start asking about guitars?
Yeah, look, we did start with a couple of Australian guitar manufacturers, and they were really good. They opened their doors to us, but you could tell there was some suspicions there, like, who are these guys and why are they prying into our affairs? And, but it was one of those things where you just got to build up trust and communicate with people. And that was really the story. Like, it's about the people and the trees that are behind guitars. So once you talk to people and they realize that, you know, in my case, I'm a guitar fan. I love the guitar. I'm not about to try and bring down the guitar industry. They start to open up and share some stories and eventually scribble on the backs of, you know, business cards or pieces of paper, who the key people are to go and talk to. And then the next challenge is to convince them to let them come and visit you. So it was a sort of combination of detective work and diplomacy, really, that opened doors and meant that we were able to, you know, I don't follow the breadcrumbs in many ways, trying to figure out where, you know, if you take a guitar and look at where it's made and you talk to people that make it, where's that wood come from and which supplier supplies you this bit here? And then you try and get, you know, manage to visit them and, well, where do the logs come from? Where, you know, which forests do they arrive from? And it got a bit murky at times because some of those supply routes are a little unclear or just difficult to follow.
So why is it so murky? Why is it so difficult then, Chris, to follow those routes, particularly from the suppliers, less so from the manufacturers, right, but from the suppliers who are receiving those logs or those wood?
Yeah, look, it's a really mixed bag of really above board, formal specialists in the tome industry who are really transparent, really open. I mean, they've got websites, they're easy enough to find, and they tended to be really cooperative, and they're really concerned with doing the right thing in terms of sustainability, so they tend to be quite open. But, you know, in any given guitar, the woods might come from, like you say, five different continents, and in some cases, places like Madagascar, different parts of Africa and South America, the supply chains can be much muddier. So there's lots of intermediaries. So it's not like you just, you know, pick up a phone or put an order on the internet and suddenly a rosewood log arrives. It's probably gone through many sets of hands and through many intermediaries to actually find its way into a guitar factory. That's been a real challenge for the industry because it's now had to clean up its act. There have been a couple of controversies around some of those supply chains for good reason. I think there's some really questionable practices in places like Madagascar and the way in which forests are managed. So the industry is having to clean its act up, and it really is now responsible for being able to show exactly where each bit of wood in a guitar has come from and to show that all the right things have been done along that chain. So trying to sort of do that in reverse, which is what we were trying to do, it did prove challenging at times.
So you said that some of those practices were controversial. What practices are you talking about?
It's particular to certain woods, I guess, but rosewood, Dalbergia species, they're a dark-coloured wood that you see on the fretboards of guitars and on the backs of sides of acoustic guitars. There are lots of Dalbergia species. They come from tropical areas across the world, actually. But for a long time, Brazil had been the main supplier, and Brazilian rosewood was considered really the gold standard timber in guitar making. But it was really pillaged, to be honest, out of a forest called the Mata Atlantica, so it's not the Amazon. It doesn't actually come from the Amazon. It comes from the coastal rainforest, which is in and around where Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro are based. But there's very, very low levels of environmental regulation and oversight of the way those forests are managed. So in the 1990s, that timber was put on a couple of endangered species lists, which means that it's you can't really export it and you're not really meant to use it in guitar making. But you'll find that there are bits and pieces of rosewood that still find their way into that supply chain. So one of the sort of tragedies of that wood, actually, when we went to Brazil and talked to wood experts and forestry experts and biologists who work in that area, one of the sort of tragedies of that wood is it's really hard to identify. It looks a lot like other dark woods that come from that part of the world. And so the, you know, the actual Dalbergia nigra, the Brazilian rosewood, could actually be, is potentially being exported out of Brazil, but being described as something else on export certificates and on, you know, permits and that sort of thing.
Could still be exported now. Sorry, Chris, is that what you say?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. And it's so there are scientists trying to develop techniques where, you know, customs officials will be able to just scan a piece of wood, scan a guitar, and be able to tell whether it's through, you know, the cellular structure of the wood, be able to tell that that wood is legit or not. But we're not there yet. And one of the sort of tragedies with rosewood is that the cellular structure is really hard to determine. It's not straightforward. It's a bit of a kind of fluid species. It's sort of related and sort of different from a whole lot of other trees that grow in the same area. So two bits of sort of dark brown looking wood, it's impossible to tell which one's actually the original and very endangered Brazilian rosewood and which is another species which is much more plentiful. So it's a real challenge for environmental regulators to control that export trade. And the guitar industry kind of unwittingly has been caught up in all of that.
And these are rare wood, right? Old growth trees. I mean, how old are we talking about here, Chris?
Yeah, it depends on the species, but spruce, Sitka spruce, which is used in about 80% of acoustic guitars around the world, use spruce for the soundboard, the top, which has the hole in it. It's strong and light and reverberates beautifully, so it's the perfect wood for making into guitars. But you need really old trees to be able to have wide enough pieces when you cut those pieces against the grain, that when you put them together, they're wide enough to make a guitar. So you're talking about 300, 400, 500-year-old trees that go into guitars, for certainly for things like spruce. It's a little different for other species. So, but you know, you're still looking, even in the case of koa, there are some interesting Australian species that are being trialed and used now in manufacturing guitars. You're still looking at 80 to 120-year-old trees. And I guess it's one of these wider forces that we talk about in the book, that the world of industrial forestry, the industry that gives us construction timber for making, building houses and making furniture, that's very much now geared into a system which is about growing trees as quickly as you can and felling those as quickly as you can to get a return on investment. So it's things like radiata pine, Douglas fir, these species that grow really fast. So there's little space in that plantation industrial forestry system now for these rarer trees, for these older trees. It's just too long to wait for the return on investment for an industrial forestry company. So the industry, for technical reasons to do with the actual woods, needs older trees in that range of somewhere between a century and 400, 500 years old. But the commercial industrial forestry system just can't really cope with that. It's not a viable thing for it to really contemplate. So it puts a lot of pressure on the guitar industry to figure out other ways of accessing trees more ethically, particularly as there's more pressure and demand and you know, there's an ethos within the industry to do the right thing.
So, Chris, we're starting to see a move to other types of species being used to make guitars. Are we also seeing a move to start planting more trees specifically for the industry from participants in the industry for the future of guitar making?
Yeah, that's right. We're seeing both of those things. So the industry itself is being forced to embrace alternatives. They often timbers that won't necessarily sound exactly the same as your classic spruces and rosewoods, but they'll still sound really good in their own right, and they have the right technical specifications to be able to, you know, to be made into guitars. So we are starting to see even the mainstream mass manufacturers actually start to shift away from those rarer species. And we're also, one of the things that we discovered was that the very same people whose livelihoods in the industry their livelihoods rely on felling trees for the guitar industry. These are specialists and not big mega sawmills or anything. They've read the tea leaves, they understand what's happening, and so they're actually starting to themselves plant trees for the future for the industry. So in the Pacific Northwest, for example, there are some specialist tonewood experts there now cultivating maple and growing trees for the future. We're starting to see that as well in Australia and in a few other places as well, realizing that, you know, this isn't a sustainable path. So it's a really fascinating thing. And one of the kind of, I suppose, poignant parts of the journey was to realize that, again, when you actually meet the people who are involved in all of this, the people who fell trees for a living, they should also care about the forest. They do actually care about the trees, but their livelihoods depend on felling them. And the first to really, I think, comprehend that you know, something different needs to be done for the future. So this sort of hopeful kind of point in the book to realise that there are lots of these sorts of experiments going on. The thing is that it'll take a long time to come to fruition, that those individuals are not going to reap the benefits of their plantings in their lifetime. So there's a certain kind of altruism and a certain kind of legacy mentality that's involved in thinking about planting and caring for forests now, knowing that it's going to be people in 100, 200, or even 400, 500 years' time that are actually going to be the beneficiaries of that activity.
You're listening to RNZ National. I'm Julian Wilcox, filling in for Kim Hill, who's back next week. We're talking to Professor Chris Gibson. He and his associate, Andrew Warren, have their new book, Guitar, Tracing the Grain Back to the Tree. It's out now. Chris, is there a prohibitive regime that exists at the moment? Because as you show, you've spoken to those who fell the trees, who log the trees, but it's obviously the big companies, the big part of town who are potentially getting away with this practice that is completely unsustainable. Is there a prohibitive regime? Are there hefty penalties and fines that are incurred upon companies who continue to do this?
There are, and it really came to a head in 2009 and again in 2011 when the Gibson Guitar Company, which has factories in the United States, their factories were raided by US Fish and Wildlife officials. And it was connected to some technical issues to do with how they were able to verify the sources of their timber. So they got taken to, legal action taken against them by the US government and accusations of being involved in the illegal trade of rosewood and ebony. In that case, they settled out of court. And look, the amount of money involved in that settlement wasn't enormous. Woods were seized, which was a problem in terms of supply for the company. But more the point was the PR effect of it. It really shook the industry, and there was a sense that, you know, musicians, varied in their philosophical and political beliefs, but as a whole tend to lean to the left and tend to be concerned about the environment. So it's really about brand reputation and management, I think, for the bigger manufacturers to make sure that they're doing the right thing. But the other thing I would say too is that it's actually also, it's a kind of a function of sheer necessity. So even your really enormous, for example, mass manufacturers based in China, which they don't market their guitars in terms of their environmental credentials by any means, they need security of supply. They need consistent supply of usable timber to be able to make guitars. It's just not physically possible to do that. It's becoming increasingly difficult, at least, to do that in a world where supply is inconsistent and unreliable, and requires extraordinary diplomatic efforts and networks to be able to access those logs. It's just not becoming a reasonable proposition anymore in terms of a business model. So sustainable alternatives have to be found, and they are being found to some extent. And the other thing I think we're looking at are changing designs for guitars. So if you think about what an acoustic guitar looks like from the front, instead of having two pieces on the front there with the soundboard with the hole in the middle, which means you need really old guitars, well, maybe we need to embrace four-piece guitar tops there. They won't sound as good, but for a reasonably well-made budget guitar, it's probably going to sound perfectly fine, particularly if you're playing on stage and you've got amplification involved. You know, it's not a concert instrument, but it will be perfectly good for most of the beginners in the world. So you'll start to see more plentiful species. Maybe they don't sound as great, but they're still structurally usable for guitar making, and just different designs and a more resource sensitive approach to the way those woods are being managed.
And obviously you also have the opportunity to use used guitars. I mean, I thought that was a big thing for a lot of musicians, right? To be able to use the guitars that someone else has played live or on certain recordings or whatever it might be, particularly for acoustics. I mean, I guess electric guitars are a little different, or are they?
Yeah, they are a little different. But it's still kind of similar, actually. People who are really into their guitars will tell you that you just can't beat old wood, and even on an electric guitar, actually. So Look, I agree with that. I think one of the bits in the book actually we discuss is what's the likelihood for the future of the industry. And it's a bit of a challenge for companies who want to make and sell new stuff all the time. But if you think about it, if you imagine that right at this moment there are millions of guitars in the world, from a resource stewardship point of view, we need to make sure that as many of those guitars remain in the world and that they remain playable, and that there is a lively market for secondhand guitars and an affordable market for secondhand guitars as well. So one of the, I think, future discussions for the industry and for guitar players as well is to think about that. And it's a challenge when we think about a lot of the budget guitars that have been made since World War II. You had a kind of boom in the number of guitars that were made in mass manufacturing facilities. Lots of those aren't the greatest guitars. They were, you know, probably corners were cut when they were made, so they don't necessarily play that well. They might have some structural problems with them. Many of them might not be retrievable from a repair point of view, but maybe some can, and maybe we need to just rethink the way in which we, well, embrace those secondhand guitars. Having said that, there's a huge market for the kind of, you know, really well-made old guitars. I mean, you could buy a house with what it would cost you to buy a 1959 Gibson Les Paul secondhand. So I'm not necessarily suggesting that we get caught up in that sort of elite obsession over the rare secondhand and old vintage guitars. But yeah, if you think about that stock of just mass-produced budget instruments that are in the world, rather than throw them out or them sitting under beds in people's rooms never getting played, we need to think about those as well from a sustainability point of view.
Yeah, recirculate, particularly for beginners, right, who are picking up the guitar now. I would have thought there was also, you know, as you say, musicians are a fairly conscious kind of bunch, right? They are environmentally conscious, a lot of them, savvy. And in fact, they write songs about, you know, ethical practice and the environment and the world. So you would have thought sustainability would have been a big thing from them, or a campaign of some sort from a lot of the world's leading musicians to talk about that. Has that not happened, or is it just not happening enough?
Yeah, it's just not happening enough, probably. It has happened. I mean, the Greenpeace organised a coalition of companies and musicians at around the time that those raids at the Gibson factories were happening, and just before that. So yeah, there have been different kinds of campaigns that have been attempting to raise awareness of these issues among guitar players. Look, I'll be the first to admit, as a keen guitar player, that one of the things that I think is really challenging, to be honest, is that we really constantly desire to buy and accumulate guitars. Like, there's a saying that the very best guitar in the world is the next one that you're going to buy. That, you know, life isn't complete unless you've got one of all each type. And that sort of mentality is something that's pretty challenging. It was challenging for me because I do own more than one guitar. And but at some point perhaps we have to stop, or at least circulate and sell, you know, enjoy the guitars we have in our life, but sell them on, maybe buy a different secondhand guitar and be a little bit more self-reflective in our own buying and consuming practices.
One of the other things I would have thought, Chris, was that, you know, with the higher production and greater production of music now, that would have had an impact anyway on sales of guitars, that you just go straight into a production studio, you've got so much accessible now online to be able to make different sounds and beats and what have you, that the use of guitars would have dwindled, or the sale potentially or purchase of guitars would have gone down. Yes, you've got the likes of Ed Sheeran and Taylor Swift, who potentially have seen an upsurge in young people who are wanting to pick up acoustic guitars particularly, but the greater production required now for mass music has meant that it would have had an impact that potentially had led to what was going on with Gibson, who I think went bankrupt in 2014 anyway. So are guitars still popular?
Yeah, they are. They're still the world's largest selling musical instrument. It does fluctuate, and it is based on musical trends. So every 10, 15 years or so, there's a sort of sense of crisis in the industry that it's all about synthesizers and sequences and, hip-hop's enormous and there's no guitars in that. So, you know, what are we going to do for the future? But then along comes an Ed Sheeran or a Taylor Swift or somebody else and sort of revives interest in it. The other thing that's happened is with COVID and with the lockdowns, in most parts of the world at least, that it's meant that people are at home and they're looking for hobbies, they're looking for things to do in their lives. And learning the guitar has become really popular. So even since we've actually finished the book and in talking to the manufacturers, keeping in touch with them, their sales are booming. They're doing midnight shifts and all sorts to try and keep up with production demand. So it's very cyclical, but it doesn't seem to be abating.
What about the use of things like carbon fiber or aluminium? I mean, are those worthy substitutes, and are we seeing a greater production of those?
Yeah, glass. You can.
Oh, glass. Okay. Some,
yeah. YouTube clips about entire guitars made out of glass. Carbon fiber is being used in different designs around the world, and certainly is a viable substitute. One of the impediments to that is that the guitar players themselves often like the feel and the sound of wood. So, and can be really emotionally attached to woods as well. So, I mean, I'm not particularly attached to guitar woods, but we recently had a launch here in Sydney for the book, and a good friend and musician helped us launch the book, who, you know, was shocked that his beloved rosewood was all bound up in all of this controversy and all this stuff, because it's like rosewood is his thing. So it's a stretch to get some people to move even beyond those classic timbers to embrace alternative timbers, and it's a bigger leap again to at least encourage some musicians to then move to an entirely non-wood guitar. This is definitely possible. I think laminates is potentially a different alternative that's good for budget guitars that's not, it's still woody, as it were, without having to necessarily go the whole hog towards carbon fiber and aluminium and glass and different kinds of experimental materials. And laminates is just essentially like plywoods, but they can actually be used to structurally to make guitars that, you know, they're not going to sound great, but for a budget, for a learner, for a, you know, my 12-year-old daughter who wants to learn guitar, that's great. That'll work perfectly fine, and you know, will mean that those 500-year-old slices of spruce don't necessarily have to end up in those budget guitars anymore.
And you looked at the footprint, right, of tracing the guitar and how far it goes, and the impact on the environment with the footprint of guitar making itself. So, what is the footprint, the environmental footprint of guitar manufacturing?
It's extensive but low impact in a certain kind of way. It's a strange one. There's about 2.5 million guitars made every year, but it doesn't necessarily translate into enormous numbers of trees being felled. So even from one Sitka spruce log, that log might be 400 or 500 years old. You can get up to 5,000 guitars out of that one log. The thing is that spruce will then be paired with a piece of rosewood that might have come from India, with a piece of ebony that might have come from Cameroon. It might be paired with something like bunya pine or Queensland maple that's come from Australia. So the tentacles of the industry spread very far across the world, really to most corners of the world. But then it's just about very particular numbers of trees, 30 trees of this species, 100 of that species across reasonably large geographical areas. So it's not like that this is causing the clear felling of forests across the world. It's not. It's much more peculiar than that, actually. So one of the things, and some of the characters that we met along the way, are these individuals, intermediaries that are able to access those trees, increasingly indigenous knowledge holders and land owners are involved in the industry.
How are they getting involved, Chris?
Well, in places like Canada, for example, where treaty negotiations are still ongoing, Indigenous knowledge holders and rights holders have access to the trees and have rights over those forests and how they're managed increasingly. So instead of negotiating with big industrial forestry companies whose business model is to come in and clear fell forests, those Indigenous knowledge holders are looking towards different kinds of agreements. So developing their own enterprises that are based on much smaller forestry activities, just, you know, felling just individual trees or smaller areas in a much more sustainable way that are in tune with Indigenous values, but then working with intermediaries to supply little niche industries like the guitar industry, where they can earn a lot more for that same log, basically, and not have to clear fell huge areas for that to be a viable proposition for them.
Yeah, we spoke to Susan Samard about this actually a couple of weeks ago, who I think is the inspiration for Avatar, who talks about mother trees and Indigenous cultural practices that have been seen in Canada, which have been picked up in a much more, you know, in a greater fashion now than certainly was the case 20 years ago when she started getting into forestry.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think there's still a lot more room for the industry to embrace and work with Indigenous knowledge holders and land holders and rights holders. And, you know, benefit sharing is something that I think other industries have embraced, and the guitar industries, it's on a journey towards that, but there's still some way to go.
Look, so I know you're a guitarist, and potentially I might be getting way off topic here, but I think it's interesting to talk about because you mentioned a 59 Les Paul. I still think one of the greatest Les Paul electric guitar players of his time was Gary Moore, who passed away in 2011, who you don't hear, you know, in terms of the greatest guitar players in the world, you always hear about the Hendrixes and the Brian Mays and the Jimmy Pages and the Van Halens and Claptons and so on and so forth, but you hardly hear of a Gary Moore. I mean, you did say that those kind of guitars are really expensive. I heard a rumour he sold his for $1.5 million or something like that. Is that the kind of astronomical figures we're talking about for some of these really old Les Pauls, 1959s, 1960s?
Yeah, you sure are. Wow. It's a rarity thing. So there were only so many made. I don't have the number in front of me, but there were only so many of them made. When they came onto the market back in the late 50s, they weren't a tried and tested model. They were quite high-end because what Gibson did is they used instrument-making practices that they'd inherited from things like mandolins and arch-top guitars, violin making, which are quite labor-intensive and expensive. So they didn't make that many, and it wasn't a wildly popular model. So there's only so many of those in the world. So that kind of, in a way, that artificially inflates the secondhand value of those guitars. But if you add in the provenance, I mean, if it was played by a famous musician, particularly on a recording, then it's crazy. There's actually a whole industry, really, a market for high-end vintage guitars, especially with provenance like that, among a kind of super rich elite crowd, I suppose, the hedge fund managers and tech entrepreneurs in California. Yeah, it's sort of bound up in a lot of those sort of bragging rights. And so sort of sadly, in a way, a lot of those instruments end up hanging on the walls of corporate boardrooms and
Hard Rock Cafe, this sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. They're sort of trophy instruments rather than actually being played. And I think for me, one of the things about guitars is, I mean, we cherish them, we love them, we look after them dearly, but they've got to be played. They're built to be played, not to be put in a cabinet or, you know, hung on a wall forever without ever being played.
So the final question, no pressure on this one. Who's the greatest guitarist of all time again? Sorry.
Yeah, no comment about that.
God, oh, come on, Chris. Come
phone
on.
Phone calls for years. look, I have my own personal tastes. I'm a bit more understated in the guitar playing styles that I like. So someone like J.J. Cale who, you know, sadly passed away, but was really influential on a whole generation of guitar players, including Eric Clapton and Mark Knopfler and so forth. He just had a really beautiful touch in his fingers. And if you listen to those old J.J. Cale recordings, the solos are just understated. They're not over the top, but there's just so much soul and emotion in his playing. So for me, I'd probably nominate J.J. Cale.
Good choice. I mean, lots of names that people mention. There's others that I don't hear a lot of. Felicia Collins, who used to be the lead guitarist, actually, for David Letterman's, you know, band back in the day. Elizabeth Cotton, who's an interesting one, right? Left-handed kind of player, who was a banjo player initially, and then cotton picking became her thing. You've got an Australian, actually, female artist, amazing. Is it Oriental or something, who was a backing guitarist for Michael Jackson, actually? Australian female guitarist is an amazing guitarist. Anyway, I've gone completely off topic. I apologize. And I'll put pressure on you unintentionally. See, this is what happens when you talk about the guitar. look, the other one I was interested in is the next project doing something like wood that's involved with other instruments, like pianos or anything like that?
We've been thinking about that, actually. I mean, the worlds cross over. So one of the things we realised going into the history of guitar making is that there are crossovers in the woods, and we traced Sitka Spruce back to an old factory, since been demolished, but an old factory in the Pacific Northwest that actually made piano parts, and then it made guitar pieces as a bit of a side project. And we were able to track down some of the surviving workers from that factory who were still alive and had a bit of a reunion with them to talk about that. And it did open our eyes to the prospects that piano making and the woods involved in that is another related and fascinating story that maybe we could explore a little bit further in the next one.
Hey, you're welcome. You're welcome. Look, thank you again for your time. We wish you well for the book, Guitar, Tracing the Grain Back to the Tree. Chris Gibson, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it.
Pleasure.
That was Chris Gibson.